The Fargo Public Library presents their Fall Into Jazz concerts featuring local jazz artists Saturdays, October 4th through the 25th, starting at 4 p.m. at the downtown main library. More information at fargolibrary.org.
Welcome to Wednesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and coming up in the second half of today's show, we're talking about financial planning in the sense of what we do today has an impact on how we can live tomorrow. Financial expert Ty Lasseter will join us, but first we open with Prairie Plates.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
This is Prairie Plates, served weekly here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. This is your host, Rick Yeon, and we have another special guest in the studio today, Andrew Doan with Nova Eatery and Supper Club in downtown Fargo. Andrew, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Hey, thank you. Excited to be here.
It's good to have you here. And let's start out talking about, what is Nova Eatery and Supper Club?
Nova Eatery and Supper Club is the brainchild from Nikki and Ryan Nitschke. It's a take on Midwest classic supper clubs. We have everything from classic prime rib at night to beautiful breakfast sandwiches in the morning, cheesy hash browns, which were inspired by the funeral potatoes that people sometimes eat at funerals. We just try to keep it kind of homey, but on an upscaler level.
I do eat breakfast or brunch at Nova quite a bit. You could see me in there. And I do drink them out of coffee sometimes because they do have coffee too. Andrew, what's your history in the food service industry? We've known each other for quite a while.
So I actually started cooking when I was 16, just at like a little hot stuff pizza back home. Kind of got into it. Went to culinary school at NDSCS and cooked at a breakfast joint down there for a couple of years, moved up to Fargo, worked at Johnny Carino's for about 6 months before one of my friends moved me over to the Hotel Donaldson, and I've been cooking farm-to-table, fresh, kind of local-ish foods ever since, so probably since like 2012-ish. Been floating around the downtown scene.
Well, yeah, we got to know each other at Hodo a little bit, and well, we all miss Hodo.
Yes.
You learned a lot there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Definitely expanded my horizons quite a bit. Went from being just a simple breakfast cook to somebody who got to see the farmers bring in and drop off ingredients and got to do the one thing that my parents told me never to do, which is play with my food, and I haven't stopped since.
And you worked for Chef Ryan Nitschke, who you still work for.
Yep. I've worked for Chef Ryan Nitschke, just him, for about 10, 12 years, and then with Nikki Berglund for about 9 years.
And for those not familiar, those two are multi-James Beard semifinalist nominees here in Fargo. We're very proud to have a lot of talented people in the food industry in North Dakota these days. Andrew, you talked about where you were from in North Dakota, and this being Prairie Public, we like to talk about Germans from Russia, and your last name is definitely Germans from Russia. Where are you from in North Dakota?
So I come from a very small town located near Ashley, North Dakota, and between Eureka, South Dakota, called Venturia. I grew up there on a farm maybe about 7 miles outside of town.
And, yeah, that Germans from Russia food influence, did you make any cheese buttons or placenda or any of that stuff?
I grew up watching my mom make cheese buttons, homemade strudels, egg noodles. We were very much like a self-sufficient farm, so I grew up like learning how to butcher and smoke meats, make homemade sauerkrauts. We did a lot of canning, you name it.
Well, this week we're going to talk about football foods. Maybe that's football foods in South Central North Dakota. But this week we'd like to talk, it's getting to be football season. Next week we're going to talk about soups, and it's soup season too. But let's maybe start out talking about how to make a good burger.
Oh, absolutely. I'm pretty staunch on sticking to the 80-20 mix of 80% protein, 20% fat. I personally prefer the smash burger over the big fat juicy burgers you see. They're just quicker, and if you're feeding a crowd at a tailgate, you probably don't want to stand there all day keeping an eye on a big fat burger while you're trying to drink some beer and enjoy sports. So high heat on some cast iron, maybe like a Blackstone. Smash it down with like a bacon press with a little piece of wax paper so it peels away and you don't have to struggle with that. Let it cook 80% of the one side, and then you can flip it over, and it's probably done within 3 to 4 minutes, honestly, depending on the size of your wad that you have for your burger.
And we'll talk about smash burger at Nova here in a little bit. But when I think football foods, too, I think about chicken wings. And I was at a rib cook-off on Saturday, and one of the cooks made a bunch of chicken wings on a big Weber Ranch-style kettle grill. So he was grilling them over charcoal, but a lot of people like them deep-fried. A lot of people like them smoked. I don't know. What's your favorite way to have wings?
You know, it's a tie. I really like the love and the time that goes into a smoked wing. But like I said, I'm kind of a quick hurry up, let's get going because I got stuff to do. So I love a deep fried wing, or even like if you like par baked it so you could deep fry it so it takes less time. I really like it when people do brines, especially for like a tailgate season, like a beer brine, and you can kind of sub out whatever beers you want or whatever theme you're going for. We used to do like a Radler beer brine wing once or twice at the old location just to kind of give it a little twist on, you know, like a lemon pepper beer brined wing. It worked out really nice.
Another one is hot dogs, and I know at one of your sister restaurants, Soul Avenue Kitchen over in Moorhead, they get really creative with their hot dogs. Unicorn Park Fine Foodery, another restaurant in your network, their hot dogs are a lot of fun. Any suggestions on creativity and hot dogs?
Hot dogs, I mean, they're pretty much just a blank canvas. You can do whatever you really want to them. Topping them with chili or even cooking them in beer with some onions. You could swap out your style of hot dog for pork to beef to maybe even an Italian sausage. Throw some jalapenos in there. Toppings, I mean, honestly, you can go anywhere as long as you at least have a sauce, maybe a crunchy element or a pickled element just to kind of break up what you're eating. I recently went to Chicago and discovered that I'm in love with Chicago dogs. They're my number one dog now, so I love all the toppings, the tomatoes, the relish. I mean, you can't go wrong.
Yeah, good Chicago dog. You can't find a lot of them around here. Thursday night at Dempsey is probably my favorite one with the poppy seed bun, and they just do it right over there. But yeah, good Chicago dog, definitely worth your time. Let's talk a little bit about dips.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I'm always a sucker for the classic Midwest Rotel dip where it's the Velveeta, the ground meat, and a can of tomatoes and chilies. But that's also pretty interchangeable as well. Like, you could throw some kimchi in there, some bacon, some roasted garlic. I mean, you can't go wrong with Velveeta. It's pretty much one of the best vessels for any kind of dip that you want to do, as well as cream cheese. I probably have Velveeta pumping through my veins. It's so Midwestern and ingrained in me. I also thought that maybe, like, you could do a play on, like, a French onion dip, but, like, maybe deglaze the pan with some bourbon instead of, like, your typical wine, just to give it kind of, like, a Midwest, like, warming feel since it is getting a little colder out. Served with, you know, bread, crackers, chicken and biscuits, whatever. You can also, you're in the Midwest, so honestly, anything you mix into some cream cheese can be considered a dip. My family likes to do... every once in a while, we'll do like a Dunkaroo dip, which is honestly just a box of Funfetti cake mix and some vanilla pudding, Cool Whip, and you serve it with some animal cookies. So, I mean, another broad horizon that you can just do whatever you'd like.
Well, chili is another one of those, and you and I are going to judge a chili contest on October 19th at the Talk Music Center for Excite Music, which is a needs-based music scholarship program. Kids can get lessons for free, and we're going to judge over there, and that's going to be a lot of fun. But there's a lot of controversy, and I've spent a lot of time in the Texas Hill Country, so I like chili that is just has meat, like braised meat, braised chuck, braised brisket. Beans or no beans, or do you care?
It depends on the purpose of the chili. Like, if I want it on like a hot dog, no beans. I mean, that is a different type of chili. But if it's a cold day, I'm like a lighter bean kind of guy. I'm not a big fan of the red kidneys, but if there's like navy beans or even like black beans, or sometimes I've seen people put garbanzo beans in there. Whatever you got laying around the house. I have, I have no staunch setting on chili with beans or without.
I like some pinto beans in there every once in a while, too. That's pretty good. Speaking of that style of Tex-Mex, guacamole, any tips on guacamole? It's a little healthier option.
People are always asking, how do you prevent it from turning brown? Honestly, I have done everything from leaving an avocado pit in there to pushing saran wrap down so it's airtight, and then putting a layer of water on that saran wrap to really prevent the air from getting in there. It's just to keep it from browning. It doesn't really affect flavor or anything. You pour it off, open it up, and you should be good to go.
Those tips are very helpful, because if you leave it out too long or put it in the fridge and don't cover it tightly or put a layer of something on there, it can turn brown and just kind of have a different flavor. So those tips are very much appreciated. Let's talk a little bit about what Nova offers for football-type foods. We talked about the smash burger. Are you making smash burgers? What's special about the one at Nova?
So the one at Nova is from our original location when we were located in Fargo Brewing Company. We wanted something that would be has the nice caramely crust, the caramelized onions, and we made like a beer cheese sauce for over the top. People loved it so much that we just had to bring it to the new location. Probably one of my favorite burgers to eat in town, but that's just me tooting my own horn.
I just had one yesterday, so. Bacon burnt ends, I think they're delicious. Talk about that a little bit.
So we get giant slabs of Cloverdale slab bacon in. We cut it into about quarter-sized pieces. The trick is to toss it in a lot of finely ground black pepper, some garlic, maybe some cumin, and then we slow roast them in a very low oven for about 40 minutes. Slow roasting it provides the fat to kind of melt out while keeping its shape and content. And then when we pick it up, it just goes into the oven for 5 minutes with whatever sauce you would ever like to put on there, and it caramelizes on there quite nicely.
Yeah, those burnt ends are delicious. Another thing you guys do over there is a snack mix with some Chex mix, goldfish, pretzels, that sort of thing. Any tips on how to make a good Chex mix or that style of mix?
Absolutely. Lots of butter, thyme, and patience. You put butter on there, whatever seasonings you'd like. I'm not going to go into detail about what I put on mine because it's kind of a guarded secret. Chef Ryan would be listening and waiting to hear and write this recipe down. So just a low oven, giving it a toss every 15 minutes. Butter, Worcestershire, and whatever seasonings you'd like. And honestly, whatever kind of cheesy chip or Chex you want to put in there.
I can taste the butter in it.
That's the love.
That's what makes it good. They can tell you're from South Central North Dakota. Chicken tenders.
So we do have a chicken tender. It's kind of a play on the sandwich that we used to have. So we do deep fried chicken tenders, and then we toss it in a honey and chili garlic butter that we make in-house. That is a recipe that followed us from the old location. Once the chicken comes out, we toss it in the butter, just because it's the Midwest and you can't have enough butter and you need to survive the winter somehow. Gets served with our house-made ranch, house-made piece of toast that our wonderful pastry chef Mandy makes in-house, and just some French fries with some seasoning on there.
Well, we'll end on that. If that doesn't make you hungry, I don't know what will. Chef Andrew Doan, thanks for coming in today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be here.
And next week we'll hear from somebody at the Sons of Norway about soups, because it is soup season. This has been Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. We'll talk to you next week.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents the 1925 silent film The Phantom of the Opera, with live orchestral performance from the Theater Pit, conducted by Jane Lynn Capistran. October 25th, 7:30 p.m. at the Fargo Theater. Ticket information available at fmsymphony.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and the deadly Enderlin tornado over the summer left many in eastern North Dakota shaken. And while video of the damage of the homes initially looked like it may have been a stronger storm than classified, it was a train that got the storm a higher ranking. Here's this week's regional news podcast, Prairie Beat.
After spending several months analyzing it, it was found to have needed at least winds of 210 miles per hour to cause the type of damage, because there were several train cars that were pulled off the track, but there was one in particular that was lifted up, and it wasn't drug, it was dropped in the field. And so that was what was used to determine that it was EF5 intensity at that point during the tornado's lifespan.
Hey, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We're back again for another episode of Prairie Beat,
our weekly discussion of headlines blowing through the Prairie Public newsroom. Sorry about that, Danielle. Couldn't help myself. But since I already know this week's topic, I couldn't resist that not so subtle teaser.
Absolutely. So yeah, this week we will once again be discussing the June 20th Enderlin tornado. Nearly 4 months later, it's no longer old news, because this week the final evaluations were released and the initial EF3 rating has officially been upgraded to EF5.
Upgraded. I feel like I'm getting a first class seat or something. Not so much. The reason this is such big news is because it's been more than 12 years mm-hmm. nationally since an EF5 tornado has been rated. Here's the unmistakable voice of the late great NPR reporter Wade Goodwin describing the deadly tornado in Moore, Oklahoma.
Brown closed the shelter's trap door and listened. At more than 210 miles per hour, the wind ripped his garage door away like a piece of cellophane. Then he heard a massive groan, the roof being sucked off the frame.
And, you know, Danielle, I didn't think, just seeing all the photos and videos of that tornado here in North Dakota, bringing it back to Enderlin, I didn't think it was an EF3. I actually was thinking 5.
I felt the same way. I thought, you know, that's got to at least be an EF4. But we had to wait for the final word. That tornado, if we'll recall, took place on a pretty volatile night in North Dakota. The same night, a massive derecho churned across almost the entire length of the state. I was able to talk to Blake Rafferty. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Grand Forks about this news. And we talked about the days leading up to the final forecast for that night. And I am not often freaked out by a forecast, but this one really had me rattled.
As we went through the day, and it became evident that the cap would break in some form in southeastern North Dakota, that's when the forecast definitely got people to take action, became more dire. And then obviously the warnings when the atmosphere, when the cap was able to break, instability was in place, you had wind shear, all that combined created a very buoyant air mass for the supercell to develop and then drop the tornado.
There was a lot of widespread damage, a lot of folks who lost electricity. One person did unfortunately lose their life near Courtney. This EF5 tornado that hit rural Enderlin slammed two homes, tragically killing three people there. And as it took a sort of northwesterly turn, that derecho caught up to it and pretty much absorbed it and stopped it in its tracks.
Yeah, I mean, thank goodness for that in a way, because obviously if it hit the FM area or any parts of it, man, it could have spelled a lot more than the tragically three people who lost their lives in that storm in the rural parts of Enderlin. That night was so surreal, Danielle. I remember it like it was yesterday. And the following day, you know, all those pictures that came out really showed what was going on that night. I think the imagery that really caught everyone's attention was the Ring doorbell footage that recorded the storm's mesocyclone as the tornado went by. And I mean, that thing looked absolutely terrifying.
Terrifying.
I mean, lightning flashing and illuminating. This monster looked like an upside-down mushroom cloud. It was so wide. Something you might see, you know, I was thinking, I think you were thinking too, like, you know, Hawkins, Indiana, the upside down that we all know on the Netflix series Stranger Things, which I think is coming out with another season soon, but not something you would see on the plains of North Dakota.
Right. You know, storms of that size and strength are certainly not the norm around here, but they can and do happen on occasion. Before this tornado, North Dakota recorded only two F5s. May 29th, 1953 at Fort Rice, North Dakota, where 20 people were injured and two were killed. The entire town was basically wiped out. And then 4 years later, 68 years ago to the day of this Enderlin tornado, June 20th, 1957, the famed Fargo tornado, which claimed 10 lives and dozens of homes in North Fargo, along with over 100 other injuries. That was one of the twisters that Dr. Ted Fujita studied to create that tornado rating scale that we know today as the enhanced Fujita scale.
Yeah, Fargo plays a big role in the Fujita scale. We joked earlier that the F in Fujita might actually be F for Fargo. You know, I mean, it does play a significant role in weather lore, does this area. So in our episode we did right after the June 20th storms, we did go a little bit into how the enhanced Fujita scale measures tornado damage. It's been 4 months now since the storm, and I've been reading about how the National Weather Service and then engineers from the Canadian Severe Storms Laboratory spent all this time really evaluating the damage and all the structures, what everything was made of, the materials, and how strong it was to determine that final rating. That can take a lot of work, I imagine, and a lot of time to finish.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was really chilling what this tornado was able to do. The specific damage that confirmed the EF5 rating was destruction to some trees on the Maple River. The trees had been debarked with a sandpapering effect. And then there was a train that was derailed off its tracks. 33 train cars full of grain were knocked off the track. And then one car in particular, it was an empty tanker car weighing 72,000 pounds, was fully lifted and then dropped more than 475 feet away. There were no drag marks in the field around that train car. So they determined the only way this could have happened was if peak wind speeds were more than 210 miles per hour. And that is EF5 strength.
It's one of those things that's very rare, and we're lucky it's rare, because when these tornadoes do happen, they cause a lot of damage. And so it's a good thing that we don't see too many large and destructive tornadoes such as this one.
Well, I'm glad, and we should all be glad, that EF5s are rare events. Danielle, you and I both were in the West Fargo area. That's where we live, and we both were watching the tornado coverage as the storm, this monster, got closer to our area. And I had my 9-year-old, and we're in a split level, and I mean, we had blankets. We were ready to jump into the dry bathtub and cover her up, and I mean, it was that close. And I remember at one little point watching the meteorologist on TV, that storm, well, it might take a little turn towards Horace right now. And Horace, as you know, is right on
edge
of the metro near where we are in our neck of the woods. And eventually, like you said, that derecho caught up to it and really adjusted the trajectory of that storm, pushing it more of into a due east pattern. And that's what pretty much saved the southern fringes of the Fargo metro area. But man, scary, scary night, as I know it was for you and your family.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we were watching it too, pretty closely at our house. We got the kids into bed, and then we turned on a live feed from this storm chaser we really like to watch. He actually broadcasts from his living room in Kentucky, of all places.
Oh, wait, is this a guy that looks like Dwight Schrute?
A little bit. Yeah. And he has all these radars up that he's looking at, and he's explaining everything. And then he has a whole team of chasers in the field who feed in their live streams to him. So it's a pretty fascinating way to watch the weather. And watching him cover North Dakota in our backyard was pretty scary. I've watched him do a lot of other areas, but our area, that was different. He has this motto about don't be scared, be prepared. And he's usually pretty even keeled, but that night he was a little more skittish, I think. He was very disturbed by the Enderlin tornado and was almost in disbelief at how big it was. I was ready to go to the basement before we heard the sirens, but we kept waiting and watching, just kind of not really believing how serious everything was, even though we were watching it. And then when those sirens went off, down we went. And thankfully, by the time we got the kids out of bed and into the downstairs bathroom, like you said, that tornado collided with the derecho and disappeared. And like you said earlier, you know, it had it ventured into Horace, West Fargo, or Fargo, that was a big tornado. It was over a mile wide.
An EF5. I mean, it's not even speculative to say that more people would have perished had that hit a major populated area. It's an EF5. We know what happened in Moore, Oklahoma. That's exactly the kind of thing that happened there. All right, so what else is up?
Our effective interest rate is 2%, which definitely helps the communities out.
Well, this week I wrote a story about four communities in the state being awarded state loans to improve their drinking and clean water infrastructure.
We have maybe just a little bit fewer people coming from Canada.
Todd had a great story about the U.S. and Canadian relations in northeastern North Dakota.
Excellent story.
Yep.
Somebody who has a background in public education has actually worked in a classroom.
And then Dave wrote about our state superintendent of public instruction, Kirsten Baszler, being confirmed for a position in the Trump administration in the education department. Stakeholders now wonder who will replace her.
All kinds of things happening in North Dakota and the country. No such thing as a slow news week, Danielle. Thank you.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, so that will do it for this week's Prairie Beat. I am Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can subscribe to Prairie Beat wherever you get your podcasts and hear it every Wednesday right here on Main Street. Still to come on Main Street, what are those cups of coffee costing you years from now? Would you believe $100,000? That's ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Think about the fact that it's no secret that Americans love eating out. I know I sure do, but the question becomes, what's it really costing us? Well, a new report shows that we spend nearly $5,000 a year dining out, more for some, a little less for others, but that many contribute less to their retirement savings than they do for these meals that we like to eat out. Joining us is Ty Lassiter. He's the CEO of Lassiter Capital, and he says the problem isn't just discipline, it's mindset, and he calls it a financial blind spot that's stealing freedom from our future selves. Ty, welcome to Main Street.
Hello, Craig. It's great to be here. I'm glad to be on the show today.
We are glad that you are with us. Tell us what's behind this new data that shows Americans spend nearly $5,000 a year eating out, more than they save for retirement.
You know, I think with everything that's going on in the modern day family, we've just seen so many changes from what the American dream once was to what it is now. And a lot of it boils down to affordability. And then you couple on top of that all of this distractions that are created from, you know, just from simply having this phone device in front of us. And, you know, we've got across the United States, the median home costs about $450,000, but median household income is about $64,000. Well, in order to afford that almost $500,000 home, you've got to make about $125,000 a year to afford it. And so families just aren't there. America is coming to a renter's nation, much like the UK is. We've got population on the rise, supply of housing on the decline. And so people are being a little bit more transient. And with transient, you look for efficiencies. And eating out is one of those efficiencies. You know, it has become very easy to order groceries now and have them delivered to the doorstep. Well, people are paying a premium for that. And with that premium, it almost is just as cost effective to go eat out, and it's quicker to do so. And so you've got the modern family that is starting to have kids later in life, and they've got so much going on in their life. They just are distracted by so many things that eating out is easy and simplest. And I'm a perfect example of that. I mean, I've got three kids. My wife is a stay-at-home wife. She takes care of our kids. All three kids are in three different places all at the same time. And so all of a sudden you find yourself not having the time to cook a meal, and it's 8 o'clock before you realize it, and the kids are done with their extracurriculars, and you've got to have something to eat. And the simplest thing is to go eat out.
You describe this as a financial blind spot rather than a discipline issue. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I study other people and businesses that have been successful. And I try to, you know, history repeats itself. The founding fathers of America had disciplines in place that allowed them to build much of the infrastructure that we see in America today. And I had the fortunate opportunity to play for football for a really good high school that led to a college career that I was able to play in college and help cover some of the cost of my college. And, you know, with that, I created disciplines. And when you have discipline of something, you're going to be successful no matter what it is. You can go back to, you know, I was never going to be a professional athlete. I didn't have a dream to do that, but you can study professional athletes like Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan. And the reason that they were successful, both of them struggled in high school, but they showed up earlier and stayed later, and they had a disciplined approach to every single day with what they did in their craft. And that the same holds true with finance. And so most people have one bank account, maybe two, maybe they have a checking and a savings. And so all of their money goes into that one account, and it becomes very, very simple for them to just spend it as it comes in and not have a disciplined approach to managing their financial resources. And so every at the end of the day, money is an inanimate object, no different than the fish tank behind my desk, than the art of the cardinal behind your desk. And so money is an inanimate object, and inanimate objects have to have a job, and that job has to be directed by us as humans. And so if we don't give a job to every single dollar that comes in, then that dollar is going to find itself somewhere else naturally. That's just going to happen. And so the best way to do that, number one, is to keep a budget. But number two is to keep at a minimum of three different accounts. I keep four different accounts. As my faith has it, I have an account for my tithing. And then I have an account for saving and investing. And when my income comes in every single month, I put 10% in that I'm going to tithe. And then with what's left over, I put 50% of what's left over into saving and investing. And I can't touch that money. And then the other two accounts that I have, I split it up between the necessities, so my housing, food, and things like that. And then I have an account for fun, whether that's, you know, we want to go shopping this month, we want to eat out a little bit extra, we want to save for a vacation, whatever the case may be. And I spend from those accounts. Now, I started doing that when I was making less than what the median household income is, when my wife and I were broke. And I just learned to get disciplined. I learned to, at that point, my splits were a little bit different. I saved 25%. So I operated, you know, net 25% for savings, net 10% for tithing. I operated on 75% income. Didn't get to do very much fun things. But that being said, I was able to put enough money aside to start my business and then build second and third streams of income from that, so that now I'm able to live on 50% of what I make very simply, and we enjoy vacation and things like that quite a bit. And so it's that discipline of having a job for every single dollar that comes in and holding yourself accountable to what you said that job was going to be for that dollar.
So does that come down to instant gratification here? I mean, you feel good after you go eat. It was easy, like you say. It was convenient. We were in a nice place. It was a good meal. We got something out of it immediately. Well, I could have also put $50 or $100 into the retirement fund, especially when I'm younger. You know, it's a delayed gratification there for sure. Is that the issue that we're facing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have always looked at, you know, instant gratification versus my goals. And I always have, I've had goals since I was very young. I remember when I was 8 years old, I said, I'm going to play college football. And that was a goal. And so I think setting a discipline for yourself of short-term sacrifice for long-term gain, and you do that over a period of time. I mean, another example of that is there's been times in my life when I was not as physically fit and healthy as I am today, but there's also been times that I was probably in better condition than I am today. But I do that because I am accountable to myself that I get up at 4:30 every morning. I want to take my kids to school some mornings. I've got my business starts early in the morning. So I get up at 4:30. I get up and I read and I fuel my mind. And then after I get done reading, I start my workout, and I work out and I go for a walk. And that's a discipline. And it's not fun to get up at 4:30 in the morning for the first month of doing it. But then once you get through that first month, it just becomes natural. And so it's the same thing with really everything in life. Just have a little bit of short-term sacrifice so that you can set up for yourself that long-term gain of whatever goal it is that you want to accomplish. And, you know, I think you can kind of go back and for those of you that really struggle with that, I was watching a video the other day that most all of us have a coffee a day, and a lot of us go spend that at Starbucks every single morning. If you were to take the money that you put into Starbucks every single morning for a coffee and invest it in Starbucks, after 5 years, you're going to have well over $100,000 in an investment account after just 5 years. And then
I think some people's jaw just dropped to the ground.
Yeah.
Enjoying our conversation with Ty Lassiter. He's the CEO of Lassiter Capital, joining us from his office near Dallas, Fort Worth. And he says the problem isn't just discipline, it's mindset. And he's talked about a financial blind spot that's stealing freedom from our future selves. All right. Give us, if you could, Ty, some practical steps. You've given us the advice. Give us the practical steps of how we can shift from impulse spending to intentional saving without feeling deprived.
Yeah. So, you know, I think what I have done well and what I did early on, this was more than a decade ago, when I was living on $54,000 with myself and my wife and a young child, that, you know, it's difficult to take that $54,000 and put $5,000 back that I'm going to give with, and then, you know, put another roughly $12,000 back that, I'm not going to spend. I'm going to save or invest. And so now all of a sudden I'm living on really close to the poverty line at that point. And so that is absolutely a struggle. But what I did was, I created an account, a separate bank account that I could put money into that we could watch grow. My wife and I could watch grow that I didn't touch until we had enough, and we would plan our vacations around that. And so I knew that, you know, I could plan a vacation around about $5,000. And so I would put money into that account until I had $5,000, and then we would plan our vacation. And so, you know, you've got to be able to, with goals, oftentimes people set 1 year goals, but they don't set, you know, silos or points at which they can set back and enjoy the gratification of working towards that goal. And so you've got to be able to do that. You've got to be able to track your goal and see where it's going and adjust accordingly. And so what I like to do, and I do this with our teams in my office, is we set a 1 year goal, but we set 90 day points at which we go back and we review how are we doing. And if we're on track, then we'll celebrate somehow. I'll take the team out to a dinner or something like that. And so, you know, people at home should do the same thing. You know, like I mentioned, set up 4 bank accounts or 3 bank accounts at the least. You've got your money for investing and building your future so that you're not working until you're 80 or 90. I enjoy what I do. My wife would go crazy if I just retired and stayed at home. And so I work from home, but I've got multifamily apartments and properties all across the country, and I go visit those. And so I'll do that until I'm 90 years old if I can. But that being said, I want to know that if something happens to me, I've got a nest egg for my family to be successful for generations to come. And so the best way to do that is sacrifice today and set that aside. Then you've got another account that is for you to live off of. And you've got to be able to live off of, you know, the banks will lend you enough money for you to buy a home on 33% of your income. You've got to learn to do that on 22% of your income. So if you can, whether you're renting or buying, do that off of 22% of your income. So then you have enough to the rest of your living expenses, food, gas, insurance, and things like that. Then you have another account that you can set aside to do those things that do give you gratification. And then set kind of milestones along the way to enjoy the fruits of your spirit at that point.
I'm approaching retirement age. Is it too late for me to course correct?
Yeah, not at all. I think this is, I use an analogy oftentimes, and this is going back to, many of your listeners probably can remember this, the old game, Oregon Trail. And it was a computer game we played in elementary school or whatever it was. And, you know, you'd be working your way west across the frontier, and a wagon wheel would fall off the wagon. And so I looked at any decision in life, no matter what the decision is, oftentimes many, many people get overwhelmed by all the decisions that they have around them. And you cannot approach every decision all at one time. You have to start with one. And so I look at it like a wagon wheel. And the best way to fix a wagon wheel is not to pick up all the spokes from the wagon wheel. The best way to fix the wagon wheel is to take the hub and one spoke. And let's start with one spoke. Once we take care of that one spoke, then we'll move on to the next one. And so the best thing to do is, no matter what age you are, whether you're 19 years old, I have a mentee that I met when he was 18 years old. And he wasn't going to college, but he wanted to get into real estate. And so I started working with him and put him on a pathway to be very successful. He was worth $1 million by the time he was 22 years old. Okay, so not all of us have that opportunity. Some of us are 70 years old and we're like, okay, what are we gonna do next? The best thing to do is to start right now. And to start right now, it's make one change, okay? If what you're doing has not gotten you to the result that you want, let's make one change. And that first change is, let's add a second bank account. And you put money into that account that you're not gonna touch. And don't touch that money until you have 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses. Once you have 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses, now start taking what is going into that account and investing it. And I invest in growth, okay? The best way to do anything is invest in growth. And I have four keys that I really look for that I kind of check off that says, okay, this investment is gonna be a good growth investment. And what I do there is, you know, I look for diversification. I do have some money in equities, but I look for counter-correlated opportunities to the market. Right now, we're sitting at a market's all-time high, but we're looking at similar situation to the 99-2000.com bubble, where there's going to be a market correction and there's overvalued tech stocks right now because of it. And so it's time to start taking some chips off the table and move into counter-correlated investments that, when the market does correct, those investments are still going to be growing. And one of those is real estate.
Let me ask you about this. Our listeners are thinking, maybe, I get it, my husband's not going to go for this, or I get it, my wife is not going to go for this. How do you bridge those conversations amongst families? What advice do you have for us to really have these kind of tough financial discussions?
Yeah, I think each family, and family is, at the end of the day, I've got a family trust. And we treat our trust much like my business. My kids are involved in the decisions that we make. My wife is involved in the decisions that we make. Some families, the wife is the financial manager. Some families, the husband is the financial manager. But everybody is involved. And so I think, first of all, knowledge is power. So the more that you can educate yourself on an opportunity, the better. But I think there's got to be a trust factor as well. And so, you know, what I do is I sit down and I listen to my wife and her input for certain things in our life. And then I provide feedback on that and vice versa. And so I think the same holds true here with the finances. It's the person who is the most financially intellectual person in the family should hold the responsibility of managing that. They should be responsible for the decisions and the support to those decisions. And then they should look to, if the kids are old enough, and specifically their spouse, for support and or feedback, because you can get tunnel vision. And so I look for positive feedback on the back end of a decision. And then, you know, one of the things that I have found most successful in decision-making skills that I have, I'm able to make decisions much faster than most people because I'm willing to just make the decision. And the way that I do that is I trust my gut. I prepare myself for a decision. I research whatever it is that I'm looking at. And then I give myself 5 seconds, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What does my gut say, and make that decision? And if I need to course correct from there, then I will.
You're not a victim of analysis paralysis?
Not at all. Not at all. Because that's when you end up finding yourself 3 years from now, not doing what you wish you would have done 3 years ago, and somebody else has, and you start living a life of should have, would have, could have.
Goes back to the saying, best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best day is today.
Right now. Exactly.
There's one mindset, a shift, if you will, that you'd like listeners to think about
about spending versus saving, what would it be?
Well, the first thing, the mindset would be just discipline. So just, you know, when I make a decision, I look at everything and I say, am I investing in growth here? Whether it's with my life, whether it's with my family, whether it's with a financial decision that I'm making, am I investing my time, my money, my energy in growth? Is this going to make something better and easier for me in the future? And if it's hard to do right now, but it's going to make my life easier in the future, I'm going to do it. And I take this back to a saying that Abraham Lincoln used to have. And he said, you know, if you task me with chopping down a tree and you give me 4 hours to do it, I'm going to take my axe and I'm going to spend the first 3 hours sharpening my axe so that in that fourth hour, I can get to work and it's going to be the most effective and efficient chopping of a tree that anybody will do. And so you've got to spend those first 3 hours preparing yourself, being disciplined and sacrificing today so that that fourth hour is smooth sailing and much easier.
Our guest has been Ty Lassiter, the CEO of Lassiter Capital. We've looked at how everyday spending habits can quietly derail our long-term financial goals and what to do about that. And you can find more about his financial strategies and retirement planning insights at their website, Lassiter, L-A-S-A-T-E-R, capital.com. Ty, it's been a pleasure.
Absolutely, Craig. Thank you for having me on. It's been great, a great morning.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, a provider of live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and streaming services for events, conferences, and meetings across the Prairie region and around the country. More information at livewirenow.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 8th. October is Archives Month, a time when archives across the country celebrate the records in their holdings and recognize the archivists who assess, collect, organize, preserve, and provide access to information of lasting value. The North Dakota State Archives is part of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. The North Dakota State Archives houses a collection of papers compiled by local WPA workers during the 1930s. These include a variety of interviews and gathered information about the specific histories of people, places, food traditions, other customs, ghost towns, legends, and even details about various ethnic groups settling in the state. These interviews and histories offer a rich selection of information about North Dakotans and the region. Many of these interviews and collected histories were intended for publication in North Dakota, but not all of them were completed before the end of this historical survey. However, the materials live on at the State Historical Society. One example is the survey of old post offices and ghost towns. This project was meant to explain why places had specific names, to be used in a pamphlet detailing how various locations in North Dakota got their names. Some material was completed, and citations of where the information came from were included. For example, Cook, North Dakota, in Adams County, was situated to be located on the proposed branch of the Northern Pacific Railroad, which was expected to be put through the northern part of Adams County. With the establishment of new rural mail routes through the territory, at about the time it became evident that the railroad was not coming through, it was abandoned. That information was provided by a man named Emil Olson. However, some information was harder to find. Workers reached out to various locations, such as Bjorn, North Dakota, to gather data like when the town was first settled, its highest population during its existence, and whether it was named after someone. While they ultimately noted there was no information available, a later compiler, Doug Wick, would add in his place names book that Bjorn is Norwegian for bear, and that one had been seen in the area. Bjorn was located 3 miles south of Manville in Grand Forks County. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on this show, we'll step inside one of America's oldest continuously operating movie houses that's in Lisbon, North Dakota. We'll take a tour. If you're listening to us on the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's next up on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it right here for Travel with Rick Steves. That's straight ahead.